watching my mother being abused had a seismic impact on me. And so it makes sense that I'm going to spend now a decade of my life photographing her. It makes sense that because I love books, as I mentioned before, I love books. I love photography books. And I love what photography books teach us.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, folks, we are getting substantial. We're getting deep and important and necessary. We're talking about the kind of photography that is personally important, personally a revelation, and can transform an entire community that actually takes personal experience, gets out there, and does good in the world. In other words, we're talking with Hannah Kozek. Hannah is the author of He Threw the Last Punch Too Hard, a photo book I had the tremendous good fortune to review on the Frames website a while back. And He Threw the Last Punch Too Hard is coming out to tie in with Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October. This is going to be an opening and a live book signing at the Glendale Central Library in Glendale, California. It's September 30th from 6 to 8 p.m. Folks, if you are anywhere in the area, you need to go see this opening. You need to go attend this signing because this is one of those photography books that really can get out there and change the world. It was shortlisted by the Lucy Foundation as one of the best first photo books of the year. And as you know from the review in Frames, it is a book that I found compelling and necessary. This is not unique in Hannah's life. She's got solo exhibitions at the New Mexico Holocaust Museum, the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. Just the list of exhibitions, solo and group, the list of publications is endless. Hannah's work is one of those bodies of work out there that I think is necessary. Hannah, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
My goodness, Scott, what a gracious and kind introduction. Thank you. And thank you for having me here today and also to Tomas, both of you.
Well, it is certainly our honor and our pleasure. This is work, and not only this book, we're going to get to a lot of your work today. Work that is, I think, really right up there in the top tier. But let's dive in to the deep end first. You've got this opening, you've got this splendid new book, He Threw the Last Punch Too Hard, which is a difficult, a loving and a difficult book. Some people have read the reviews, some people have not. Give us the general premise. How did this book come to be?
This book came to be because I was a stunt woman in Hollywood, and I jumped out of a helicopter on top of the tallest building downtown and broke both my feet. And that accident forced me to go inward and be silent and quiet. And I realized that while I was in my bedroom alone crying, that I needed to work on my relationship with my mother. My mother was left brain damaged by her second husband, who was abusive. Mm-hmm. And I watched that on the weekends. I was with them from the ages of 9 to 14. And when I was 14, she ended up in intensive care, hence the title of my book, One Evening When He Went Too Far. So my spiritual epiphany was realizing that I needed to work on that relationship. And it took that accident for me to wake up, literally.
Okay, well, there's a number of things in there that need to be unpacked. First of all, I mean, you were sneaking onto movie sets before you were a stunt woman. I mean, you were taking pictures of Starsky and Hutch. So, I mean, the camera came into your life before that. How did photography even first enter into the list of things that you do?
My father had a Kodak Brownie Hawkeye, and in the early 70s, I was around 10 years old, Scott. He gave it to me. I think there was something inside of him that saw something inside of me that needed self-expression, and that's when it started. And after that, I had a Minolta SRT 201 with a 50mm 1.4 lens, and that's when it started.
Was it just the appeal of getting to see movie stars and TV stars, or because you were selling these pictures? You didn't just take pictures for your bedroom wall. You went out and tried to make a name for yourself as a photographer.
I was always a bit of a hustler, like my father. but I mean, no, initially it wasn't chasing around TV stars. It was my family. It was my friends. It was my pets. That's how mm-hmm. it started. And once I figured out a way to sneak onto these movie studios, so I think about it now because you can't do that now. It's actually impossible. I was selling my photos to movie magazines, and that was very fun. And it was Starsky and Hutch and Charlie's Angels and, you know, family. Back then it was a different era, of course. So.
And so you're working in a store one day, this woman comes in and says she's a stunt woman, and you decide, me too?
No, not at all. That wasn't how it went at all. When I was 10-ish, I was terrified of everything, Scott. And I mean, I could not go into the ocean Malibu without someone holding one of my hands. I was sure that the waves were going to engulf me. And so I decided I'm going to be a stunt woman, and I'm going to have to face fear every day I go to work. So that was a goal of mine. I was working at a camera store in the 80s, and a stunt coordinator came in. He had Fall Guy on his ball cap. And I said to him, I want to be a stunt woman. And he went, oh, yeah, right. You hear that from everyone when you're a stunt coordinator, because it is an unusual line of work. Uh-huh. A lot of people do want to be a stunt man or a stunt woman. And I said, listen, I was always hustling again. I'll come to the set of whatever TV show you take me to, and I'll make some good photos for you. Just bring me to work. And he goes, okay. And the next thing you know, I was on the set of Knight Rider.
Oh, my.
Uh-huh. October 12, 1982, I met a woman named Victoria Vanderkloot, who not only taught me to be a stunt woman, but she gave me this career that lasted over two decades, close to 25 years. And she's my closest friend in the world to this day, 41 years.
Oh, I love mm-hmm. it. Are all those clips on your website, are those movie clips, are those your stunts? That's you?
Those are all me, yes. High falls, stair falls, train falls, car hits, bike hits, you name it. That's what I
am completely jealous. I will admit, when I was a young boy, being a stuntman was high on my list of jobs I desperately wanted for a half an hour.
Yes, I understand.
But okay, I mean, even going on at this time, there's a lot going on in your life. Your father was Polish and your mother is Guatemalan, and your father had a difficult history.
Yes, my father survived 8 Nazi forced labor camps. And the year that I started to photograph my mother, which was actually the first photo I made of her, was December 15th, 2009. I started to photograph my father intentionally that year as well. And 10 days after he took his last breath, I booked my first trip to Poland. And long story short, I went to 19 camps in Germany and Poland to basically follow his footsteps. Mm-hmm. And I was doing that project while I was simultaneously photographing my mother, while I was simultaneously looking into what happened to Michael Jackson, the truth of what happened to Michael Jackson. So I was working on minimum of three projects for that 10-year span. And one of them was published into a book, and the goal is to get the next two published into books.
Right. We'll talk about the Michael Jackson bit in just a few minutes. I think that's fantastic. But tell me about chasing the footsteps of your father. Tell me about, I mean, because your mother and father separated, and your mother married somebody else, which then got to be the huge problem. What were you trying to recover something with your dad's history? Were you trying to simply preserve and document? Or what was the personal motivation for going back to the camps and seeing for yourself?
You know, I became obsessed with the Holocaust when I discovered the Scholastic Book Club back in grade school. And mm-hmm. I remember it so vividly. It was probably one of the highlights of my childhood, Scott, is this catalog would come and I would choose the books I wanted. And then weeks later, they would arrive in a box and it was my happy place. And there was one of the first books I ordered was called Escape from Warsaw. So there's two different types of Holocaust survivors. The one that won't stop talking about it and the one that won't. So you know what I'm trying to say there. So
right.
My father was the one who wouldn't talk about it. And because he wouldn't talk about it, it became an obsession, if you will. So I started studying the Holocaust very young. I had an interest in World War II history as long as I could remember. So when he died, I booked my first trip to Poland. I really had no idea what I was doing, except I knew I needed to see where he lived. I went in 2013. I found out where he lived through a lot of research, because after World War II, Polish borders shifted westward. So today, what was Germany's now Poland. So all the camps, Markstadt, Huntsfield, Klettendorf, Hirschberg, Bad Wurm, Irminsdorf, Dernau, all those German camps now have Polish names, which were not easy to locate. So a huge aspect of what I was doing was researching. For a long time before I would ever get on a plane, I went to his hometown. I went to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is where most of his family were murdered. And then I realized, I'm not done. I'm nowhere near done. And I subsequently kept going back for a total of 19 camps.
Wow.
And this is what made it challenging. A lot of things made it challenging. I was photographing it with a Rolleiflex 2.8F and Tri-X. Traveling with that into Poland and Germany, honestly, I held up lines in the airport because they thought it was a bomb. They went through each and every roll of film. It made it very stressful and anxiety provoking, to be honest with you. But the first time I went to Poland, I was using a digital camera, and it just didn't have the layers, the depth, and the richness of what I was trying to achieve, which I wanted the photos to look more like war-torn Germany.
Okay.
And digital photos were just a little too sharp for that. So there you have it.
Okay. I'm deeply moved by people that use the camera as a kind of autobiographical exploration of history and influences. You know, you say in someplace, I forget where, that the camera gave you both connection and separation, that it gave you a kind of closure. But I'm really intrigued by how the camera, you know, for your father's story, and then we'll get to your mother's story in just a second, how the camera provides both connection and separation. Say more about that.
The camera provides separation because when I have had a camera in my hand, I can get in anywhere, and I have my whole life with that camera. And having said that, the connection is when I first started to visit my mother, I couldn't go alone. I had to call my sister. It was too difficult for me. And so that the camera brought me exactly that. It gave me separation from my mother, but it also brought us closer. And that is the beauty of the camera. And I am an autobiographical photographer, and I use my camera as really, it's a means of exploring my feelings and my emotions. And I mean, my mother was one of my emotional predicaments, and that was my grace, was being able to get to know her with my camera. And listen, Scott, we wouldn't be who we are without our trials, right?
Absolutely.
And so my trial as a young girl was watching my mother being abused. And I'm grateful that my father saw something in me and handed me that Brownie camera.
When your mother left and went with another man, the relationship became abusive. He was alcoholic, and it became really profoundly a terrible, terrible relationship. Why did you decide to make a book out of this? Well, you know, this, most people would say this is private, this is secret, this is something that I'm going to deal with, but I don't need to share. You have made this not only shareable but really deeply poignant. Why the urge to put it out there?
To be honest, when I started to photograph my mother, I wasn't even planning to show anyone the photos.
Oh, okay.
So it was as I stayed with this for a decade, Scott, as I made photos, I realized there's something here that I'm going to have to eventually share. It's not going to be comfortable. There are certain people that may or may not like it, especially people in family. But what I realized is there shouldn't be secrecy when it comes to abusive behavior. And I have always said this, once you put that monster in the spotlight, you demystify it. And there isn't any honor by keeping secrets in your family or for your family. And really watching my mother being abused had a seismic impact on me. And so it makes sense that I'm going to spend now a decade of my life photographing her. It makes sense that because I love books, as I mentioned before, I love books. I love photography mm-hmm. books. And I love what photography books teach us, and that is editing. So of the thousands and thousands of photos that I made of her, to cull it down to something that would tell a story in a photography book, I love that. And I had to share this story. I didn't actually have a choice, if that makes sense, because I really truly believe we honor victims by giving them a voice. And I gave my mother a voice by sharing her story.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, 100%. Absolutely. Now, the book begins with pictures you did not take.
The book begins with photographs from the archives from the Kozak family, the Zarco family, which was my mother's maiden name, and my brilliant photo editor, Regina Monfort, who now lives in the south of France. We sat down, and what we did is we took the photographs and put them all over the floor of my living room. She spent about five nights here with me. And that's the way we came up with this idea, that the initial part, when you open the book, you just think you're looking at this family photo album. And mm-hmm. the photo album cover is actually a photo album her second husband gave her. So we came up with that you're looking at this and it's innocuous, right? And then you turn the page and the title tells you basically what's in store. And yeah. we thought that was more powerful than putting a picture of my mother on the cover, which, by the way, I got some help with that from Douglas Kirkland's wife. She said, don't put a picture of your mother on the cover. So we came up with that idea. My wonderful book editor and my publisher.
The images from the archives, some of them have been changed.
One image was changed, and only one. And the truth is, when I started this project, her second husband and her, there was a photo of them in circa 1970, before her accident, of course. That's how I referred to it. And he's in the photo. And then I went through a phase where I thought, I don't want him in my book. And then I went through another phase of, no. He belongs in this book. He's part of this story. So he was removed, and then he was put back in. And then I realized, okay, I don't really want to see his face, but I want him in the book. So I started scribbling on him like a child with a crayon. Mm-hmm. And I wrote what came to me, which was coward.
The images at after the pictures of your mother as a young woman, the pictures of the relationship there change, and suddenly we're in a nursing home.
Yes.
And the book makes a profound change at this point. It goes from the sort of 70s and 80s color, Kodachrome kind of stuff, into black and white. There's a big tonal change in the book, as if, okay, fantasy's over. Story time. Now let's deal with reality here. Tell me about both putting the book together, that change, but why your photography decided that this was the way you were going to go.
You mean why I was going to share the truth? The photos, basically, Scott, were me exploring the reality of my mother's life. And there was no way I was going to be able to tell this story without telling it 100%. Mm-hmm. Photography is technical, but it's also art. And I was constantly experimenting and evolving with my photography. There was a point after 5 years, and I was working with a teacher, and she said, put your camera down, you're done. But I knew I wasn't done because we know when a project's done. And all I can say is it's intuition. And so I acquired the Rolleiflex 2.8F in 2014. I started experimenting and evolving with the images I was making of my mother. I've got double exposures. I've got images made with the Holga camera. And, you know, and this unique photo style came after five plus decades of making photos. So
tell me about the picture where she's reaching out to your hand. Do you remember that moment?
Of course I do. You know, my mother was institutionalized, Scott, for so long in the first facility. It was 35 years. And there came a point where she actually didn't believe anybody loved her. And once I moved her into a better facility because she asked me. We were together one day and I said, Mama, what would you do if you could make your life different? And she said, I'd like to get out of here. And I said, Mama, I'm getting you out of here. It won't be today or tomorrow, but I'm going to get you out of here. And I kept my word to her. It took 3 years, but I got her out. Mm-hmm. And basically, we fell in love with each other. So that photograph, when I would come to visit her, she didn't want me to leave. That's the truth. And it was difficult to leave. In fact, there's a photograph in the book where she's behind the gate waiting. I still choke up when I see that photo because I had to say goodbye to my mother that way for decades. If I had the ability to take care of her myself, I would have. And believe me, I struggled with all sorts of depression and anxiety when I was younger, battling, you know, what happened to my mother. So moving her into a better facility was the best thing I could do for her. And she remembered it the day I moved her. She looked around and she said, I want to tell you, this place is beautiful and you've done a wonderful job. Huh? So she knew.
You know, one of the things you talk about is how relationships, especially, you know, difficult relationships, transfer guilt back and forth. And, you know, how you felt guilty when your mother would say, you know, when she was being abused, she'd say, don't tell anyone what you've seen. And you obeyed her wishes. I mean, you didn't tell anybody, which then sort of makes it partially your fault, you felt. Is that right?
As a young girl without a psychology degree, yes, of course I felt it was my fault. And looking back, of course, it wasn't my fault, right?
Right, right.
But as a young girl, my mother said, don't tell anybody. So I developed a strong sense of loyalty, and I didn't. But that did cause me untold guilt and a lot of depression. And so I think that is part of the project coming full circle is, now I have to tell the truth. I don't have a choice.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
You have a quote in your book that I think is just beautiful. You say, my self-portraits are a search for self-knowledge that provide me with a coherent sense of self and are the mirror I never had from my mother. Our relationship was derailed so early in my life. My early mothering experiences were associated with unavailability, loss, and rejection. Photography has reworked this relationship. And I do see in these images a rekindling of love and closeness and trust in the midst of a desperate and oftentimes very sad situation. There's a picture in here which I found really unexpectedly compelling, and that is the one where she's sitting in a chair in a shower, completely covered in towels and stuff. Tell me what's going on there. Tell me about taking this picture and what people have said about it.
So there's two parts to that image, Scott. When I started to visit my mother, after I graduated with the master's in psychology, I would come in to that facility And it was so difficult. And one day they were getting ready to shower her. And I thought, oh my goodness, I want to see where they're showering my mother. I followed them into the shower. This is a different picture that I'm referring to, but it goes hand in hand with the one you're referring to. Mm-hmm. I saw a employee hosing my mother, and I was so distraught that I made a photo, two photos, as I recall. And he said to me, put your camera down. And I said, don't you ever tell me what to do with my camera or my mother. And so to me, that was the moment where I realized, my God, my mother's not in an abusive relationship anymore, but she's still, to me, being abused. Facility. So that was one photo. Now we fast forward years later. I've moved her into a wonderful facility. And I did the same thing one day when they were going to shower her. I followed them in. And there she was, all covered very lovingly with these towels so that she wouldn't get cold. And I made a photo, and that's what you see. And yes, it's very private, but I didn't show anything that would give away too much. It was more of the going from that to where she was. That's what needed to be seen. And that's what telling the truth is in documentary photography is. And yes, a lot of people will have issue with it, and that's okay. That's really not my issue to worry about. Once I put it out in the world, I can't worry about people's thoughts and judgments.
Right.
But basically, for the most part, there haven't been a lot of judgments towards this project. People have been really taken by it. In fact, people fell in love with my mother all over the world. They asked me to ship books to Italy, to Japan, to Australia. They mm-hmm. paid more to ship the book than the book costs, Scott. People really fell in love with my mother. And even though maybe their story wasn't exactly like mine, everyone has something that happened to them when they were growing up that they can relate here. And that's why these projects that are so deeply, deeply personal attract a wide audience. When you make it personal.
No, it's just something we connect to. Once you make it personal, then I've got a mirror, as you say, something I can hold up to my own experience and say we're similar or we're different, but we've got a vocabulary now to talk about that closeness or distance.
Like I said before, the way I use my camera, I'm creating art that makes people feel. Nobody ever said art is just supposed to make you feel happy. Mm-hmm. No one ever said that. Art is supposed to make you feel, period. So the consistent element running through all of my photos is feeling and emotion. And, you know, a heavy shadow followed me since the day my mother left in 1969, Scott. So it would make sense. I'm going to put what I feel into my photographs.
There is a narrative quality to this project, which is, I mean, I firmly believe that an individual still image can be narrative, but you have the arc of a whole biography here. You have the initial pictures, the happy pictures of your mother as a young woman, then you have the troubled pictures, and then you have her in the nursing homes. I mean, there is a whole biography that you've got enclosed in this book, as well as a brilliant, brilliant piece of writing as well. When people come, and everybody, once again, Glendale Central Library opening on September 30th is this show. When people come to the show, what are they going to see?
They're going to see the first show of these images in the United States. This particular project has been shown in Barcelona, in Malaga, in Berlin, but here in the United States, it's the first time. So they're going to see the pictures big on the wall, and that impacts people differently than a book. But having said that, you know, the book still, every time you open up a book, you can still get something from it. And that's why I'm in love with books.
Uh-huh. How many images are going to be there?
We have approximately 30 images.
Okay. And you said they're going to be big. How big are they going to be?
They vary. in size from 16 by 24 to 20 by 40. There's a triptych. I don't want to give away too much. I want people to be surprised and walk in and see something.
Yep. I hope a lot of people are close enough that are listeners are close enough to get there and come in and see it. This is not your only project, however. You have a lifelong career of photography here. And I mean, we're going to get to several of these and a beautiful, wonderful website. Really impressed with the website. But I got to ask, what's with Michael Jackson?
Please ask. Or I'll tell you.
You are a fan of Michael Jackson.
I would say that's a good way of putting it. So all of my projects start organically. I didn't plan to photograph my mother. I just did. I didn't plan to go to Poland. I just did. I was on a stunt job. It was Iron Man 2. Michael Jackson had just died. Mm-hmm. I got hurt again. I only had two injuries in my entire career. And that day, I had another spiritual epiphany, and I started to figure out, like, why were they always saying these bad things about Michael Jackson? I want to find out for myself. I went and started to research and found out basically that the media was pushing this narrative that was false. Why? Because it sold papers. And I spent that 10 years where I was photographing both my mother and my father before he died, finding out that the FBI tracked him for 13 years and found nothing, that his property was raided multiple times by 70 officers and found nothing. And all of the cases were basically extortion and blackmail. The average person thinks Michael Jackson was a pedophile. It's so opposite of the truth that I had to just go down that rabbit hole and find out for myself, because it's so easy to just call names. You're just basically mimicking what social media has been feeding you for decades. So this photo essay I created is basically my search and my process of learning who this soft-hearted genius was, and not all these fabricated illusions that the media was force feeding you a steady diet. Once mm-hmm. Michael became the biggest star in the world, you get someone that comes in and is a high level of consciousness who wants to heal the world and wants to give back. When Michael Jackson was alive, there was less people starving on this planet because he gave away over $500 million. So what the media was feeding you was the exact opposite of the truth of who this young man was. And so because I would say I'm triggered by injustice.
Okay.
I'm trying to make it brief, but it's not easy to make what happened to Michael Jackson brief, because they have been basically trashing him since 1993, the first false allegations. And I'll just tell people, if you want to know for yourself, just go to Amazon Prime, watch Square One. And then come back to me when you know who Evan Chandler is, when you know who Tom Snedden is, when you know who the Me Too Arvizos are, when you know who Wade Robson is and Safechuck is. Then you can come to me and say, okay, Hannah, let's have a discussion. But until then, you don't know the truth. You only know what you've been fed.
And when you've got someone that's a celebrity who's been photographed 24/7 for decades.
Correct.
As a photographer, how do you approach a project like this?
Well, I would be giving away my project now, wouldn't I, Scott?
There's some of it online. There's a lot of pictures of flowers not memorabilia. What's the word I'm looking for? Memorials.
You know what? The memorials I have put online freely, but I have created, listen, many artists and writers have sought to reconstruct their identities through self-representation. Right. I hadn't completely formulated what I was doing with photography as a young girl, but I do know now. I've got a lot of self-portraiture with places Michael visited. I've got a lot of images that I created at different places where Michael lived and died. And mm-hmm. and I wrote that book over the course of 10 years, and each and every chapter is filled with profound evidence. And I think it will be not just of interest to the Michael Jackson fan base, which numbers billions across the across the globe. I think it'll be of interest to the average person who thinks horrible things about this young man.
Yeah. Hannah, you are an extraordinary writer as well as a photographer. But and I'm looking at something that's just astounding. The Julia Margaret Cameron Award for Female Photographer of the Year 2014 went to you for a series, Pain and Loneliness. And I'm reading the text here. I'm reading it on your website. And I'm going to quote here for a second. You write, "I'm an extremely private, concealed person, and I never allowed myself to be vulnerable. My whole life, I've played the tough girl. For 25 years, I earned my living as a Hollywood stuntwoman. In relationships, I mastered the sweep you off your feet, typically male role of the pursuer. And in my family, there was so much dysfunction that I learned how to bury my feelings. Expressing tender emotions of being vulnerable was never an option in any part of my life until I fell in love. It wasn't being in love that softened my hard exterior. It was when my love was no longer reciprocated." I mean, moving descriptions here. But this series, oh my heavens, this series is one of those things that you stare at. It is at one level, you know, simplistic, nudes, most, you know, reclining on the floor, this kind of stuff, in fetal positions. You know, pain and loneliness are in the images. But I just did it a great injustice by describing it so simply. These are tonal and constructed masterpieces. Tell me about this series. Tell me about it.
I was doing a very powerful set of yoga for a year. And the particular set I was working on, I found out later, really helps with the third chakra, with creativity. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was January 2000, and I had just finished that hour-long Kriya. I came bounding downstairs. I loaded Kodak high-speed recording film into my Nikon F4S. I set the camera up on a tripod, and I just started photographing what I was feeling. And then it was one roll of film. I looked at the images. I'm nude, and I thought, what am I going to do with these? I put them away in the closet with the rest of my negatives, which are all organized by year. And then I had another relationship that went south, and I picked up the camera again. So these images basically are me being vulnerable as I wrote, and they're all unretouched. And it's another offshoot of being revealing and being honest and being raw. But also, I like to think of them as, I always said, instead of saying, okay, I'm naked, which to me is accidental, whoops, it's no, they're nudes. That's right. Powerful, and that's purposeful, and that's intentional. And so all of these, the ones that I edited, became, and the original images or silver gelatin prints became, had them printed, and I was awarded the Julia Margaret Cameron Award, as you said, for these images. Who knew? It wasn't something I set out to do, because what I'm doing, I'm not trying to achieve awards. That's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I'm listening to something inside of me, and I have to honor that voice.
One of the series that you have on your website is, at first blush, not an autobiographical series. And this is the series called Devotion. You know, number of women at the wall in Jerusalem. And I mean, boy, you capture these people in the act of devotion, in the act of prayer, in the act of giving themselves up to something larger, beautifully. But then when I'm reading the text, this really is, at one level, about your own fascination and your own connections. So was this an accidental project that you just happened to wind up with a bunch of, you know, images of the same moment? Or was this intentional? And how much of this is really, despite the fact they're images of other people, an act of autobiography?
I think everything I do is autobiographical. And in answer to your question, something hits me inside and I honor it by listening to it. And then when I'm working with it for a while, like the images of my mama, like the images in Poland at the camps, I realize there's something here. So I just keep going. And that is the obsessive nature, I believe, of the artist. If the artist is making art doesn't make you good. It just means you have something you need to express.
Uh-huh.
So you express it. Right?
Oh, yep.
But these women in prayer at the wall, and they're crying, and they're tapped into something bigger than themselves. Well, that's phenomenal to me, that the power of their prayer can inspire and move them to tears.
Mm.
And they're doing that just by going inside, even though they're in a public place. They're not at home alone having their moment with their higher power and their belief. They're just going inside and allowing themselves to feel. And that's what this is. Everything, the thread is the human spirit with all of its pain and all of its sorrow. It always will come shining through with rapture and bliss and happiness if we allow it. If we're not just staring at a device, open our eyes and look around what's in front of you. It's everywhere, but people's eyes aren't open, unfortunately.
Well, thanks to you and your work, I think a great many people's eyes are at least in the process of opening. And I'm listening to you here, and I'm just taken aback because, you know, a lot of your work is about troubled subjects, you know, women who've been in prison for life in Bolivia, for example. Mm-hmm. But all the way through, I forget how you just said it, but there is a kind of enlightenment. There is a kind of coming out of this.
Yes.
Notion. I don't want to say it's optimistic, because these are terrible situations, and yet there is, for lack of a better word, hope. You know, even there is hope in all of these images.
That's exactly correct. There's optimism and hope, regardless of all the pain and the sorrow and the suffering. There's still hope.
Oh, well, Hannah, this is absolutely fantastic and remarkable work. You've got an important show about to open. I hope everybody and their cousin can get there. And if you can't get there, folks, go to the website. Just look at the work, because this is stuff you absolutely need to see.
That's, again, thank you, Scott. That's kind. And again, I think I'll leave with, you know, and thank you, Tomas, again, because I do appreciate it. I've climbed the summit. I'm coming down the backside now, and I have goals with getting these projects published into books,
mm-hmm.
so that there's that tangible thing left behind. And that's what matters to me. And like I was saying before, we wouldn't be who we are without our trials.
Right.
It makes up who we are. Sinead O'Connor was abused by her mother. Michael Jackson had to suffer from vitiligo and false accusations. My father survived things we will never completely understand. My mother was victimized in a way that I will never even completely understand. And so what we do is try to take all of that and make something positive out of that that can help somebody else. I think that's... And photography offered me a glimpse of a world where creativity from imposed societal expectations could be challenged.
Oh, elegantly said. Thank you very much, Hannah. It's been an honor.
It really has been an honor, and I thank you from my heart.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.